You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
For Dear Science this morning, or this afternoon now, rather, we are joined by our expert, Krishna McGovern. What's going on? How's your day going so far?
Day's going well, thank you.
That's good to hear. And we've got lots of very interesting science here. Lots of wacky, silly, crazy stories, frankly. It's blowing my mind when I was reading through some of these. And this first one, absolutely incredible.
Yeah. So first one really caught my eye. I find parasites a little bit fascinating, but also really scary for how like different sort of parasites can basically take over their host and change their behavior. And so it's really got parasitology has some really interesting stories.
Mm.
And then this science story, which is about actually making a parasite potentially work for us in a drug delivery way, really caught my eye. So first off, a little bit about this parasite, Toxoplasma gondii. It's a single-cell parasite. It's one of the most commonly encountered in developed countries. I saw something which said like maybe about a third of people are actually infected by it.
Is that the one that comes from
cats?
Am I jumping the gun?
No, that's it. It's the one that you associate with cats. Yes. So it can only sexually reproduce within cats as the host. So its kind of goal in life is to get into a cat so that it can reproduce, right? And so this is why you may have heard of it in New Zealand news when they refer to toxoplasmosis, and you kind of like, there's this, I don't remember the details of it, but like finding toxoplasmosis in dolphins and like that causing health problems. And they're saying, you know, like it comes from cats. It's also why, you know, when you're in your garden and there's cat fecal matter, you've kind of got to be careful, right? Because it could have these spores of this thing. And in most people, you're reasonably asymptomatic, like you don't really know you have it. But if you're like an infant or you're immunosuppressed or you're pregnant, it can be quite problematic. Like it can cause significant health issues. There is also the observations, there's not a real strong link yet. Like there's a lot of more study required that maybe it has some impact on human behavior.
Mm.
But in mice and rats, there's definitely been observations of like infected rats have a decreased aversion to cat urine. Mice, they basically are less anxious, they're more willing to explore, and they're less worried about predators. And these behavioural modifications are kind of, you can see that they're kind of making the mice and the rats more willing to be around where cats might find them, eat them, get infected by the parasite, and then the parasite can replicate.
Yeah, right? Naturally, right.
So you can kind of see what the parasite might have in mind in here and how it's evolved.
Yeah.
So usually we're trying to kill this thing.
Yeah.
We want it dead. It's not doing us any favours. But what these researchers have like hooked into is the fact that this parasite, like the way it's working is it's getting up into your brain, into your brain cells, and then it's secreting proteins. And it's, you know, for these secreted proteins are the why we think it then, but you get behavioural modifications, right? So when we're treated with drugs, and particularly if you need those drugs to act on the brain, it's quite a tricky thing because there's a thing called the blood-brain barrier. Mm. So basically you've got kind of around your brain, there's kind of a membrane that only lets some things in. And so if you need the drug to be in the brain and working on brain cells, it's got to get through that blood-brain barrier.
Right.
So there are different ways that have been developed to do this, but what these scientists went was, well, this parasite gets there.
Does the job.
So can we hitchhike? Like, can we hitchhike a protein on it? So they basically, genetic engineering of these toxoplasma, and basically made it so that it would excrete a hybrid protein, which was a fusion of a protein that it already excreted, plus this protein called MECP2. And basically, then they infected some cells in a petri dish, and then they infected some mice with this genetically engineered parasite. And in both of them, what they saw was, yes, you got this protein expressed, this MECP2.
Wow.
And so it's a potential way of getting something to the brain that then excretes a protein that you need. There are viral-based studies gene therapies already in studies as well. This parasite one is very, very early stages, right? Mm. So all they've done so far is they've engineered the parasite to excrete this protein, but there are a lot of potential drawbacks, like it does make people sick, right? So
right.
you would have to genetically engineer something that's more benign, mm. so it still gets through that blood-brain barrier, excretes that protein, but isn't also going to make you sick.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things as well is that because a lot of people are already infected with it, they may already have developed somewhat of an immunity
yeah,
to it.
Yeah, that was my first thought.
yeah, right.
Like, would it work?
Yeah, so it's kind of cool. In that, you know, it's something that we normally would want to kill, we could make work for us, but it's also a very long way from, you know, no one's going to be injecting you with parasites anytime soon to treat
right.
your brain.
Very, very, yeah. like, down the line sort of medicine. Yeah. That's really cool. And then tarantulas here, a bit of a hot topic in the BFM newsroom, attitudes towards spiders. Me personally, I love spiders, but not so much shared.
No, and the tarantula is one that people really get a bit icky about, right? Because it's this big, hairy spider, or, you know, there are many different types of tarantulas, but, yeah. you know, like they kind of look a bit scary. They're, you know, the things that we kind of think of as the creepy crawly, and we perhaps think of them as a mindless killer as well.
Yeah.
Which is not true, it turns out.
Amazingly, right? It's incredible stuff.
Yeah, so what these... the scientists were interested in was, you know, there has been observations of different spiders and stuff hanging out with different animals, and whether those relationships are good for both or if it's one benefiting, a lot of the time this isn't actually known, and also about how do tarantulas defend themselves. So we know a little bit, but what else? And so what they did was they actually just canvassed what literature is already out there and looking for cases of where tarantulas were spotted with other animals. And so what they actually found was tarantulas hang out with, what is it, amphibians, which we kind of knew, but also reptiles, whip spiders, harvestmen, snakes, like all these different types of animals. And so they're like, wow, tarantulas are a lot more friendly than we realised. Like, yeah.
Lots of pals around.
Yeah. And so they don't exactly know, they haven't yet established, is it good for just the tarantula, or is it good for the tarantula and the other animal? There's a lot more work to do. In the past, there's been observations of, like, frogs living in burrows with tarantulas, and they think maybe what happens there is the frog gets a home, it gets accommodation, but it, forgetting that, what it has to do is it needs to eat, like, the problematic insects and ants and the parasites that are attracted by the tarantula's food. So it's, you know, it's a mutually beneficial relationship. And so the next step is for them to more study specific tarantula-animal relationships and figure out if these are good.
Right. And would that be similar to the sort of thing where we see, like, birds on, like, big ox, is it?
Ox, yes. Yeah. You get ox peckers, right?
Yes, yeah.
And so those ox peckers, they are basically picking off the insects on the ox, and so they get food, and then the ox pecker isn't getting irritated by this. The other thing that was really interesting about the study was about the defence mechanisms of the tarantulas. So they do look very hairy, right? And those hairs are what are called urticating. So if you get them into yourself, they're kind of irritating.
Yep.
So they're designed, what the tarantula does is it kind of rubs them off at the thing that's attacking it. But what they've also kind of seen or observed through their studies is that maybe also these hairs are protecting, like, the soft bits where ants can attack them. Because tarantulas and ants, it turns out, really don't like one another.
Right.
No, they do not play well together. They're not friends. And so by having these stiff hairs, it makes it harder for the ants to attack them in the soft parts.
Right.
And the other one that was really interesting was they think that maybe the tarantulas have some form of chemical warfare as well, because there were observations of cats and dogs sniffing them and kind of wincing or expressing some dislike. But it wasn't because the tarantulas had fired some of their hairs at them, and so they were getting this irritation. It was something else. And so they're like, maybe they've got a gland that's releasing something that's
some
not
sort
bad.
Of smell weapon. So,
yeah.
Crazy stuff. And then lastly here we've got with lions, right? Also on Friends.
Yeah.
Lots of animals hanging out.
Yep, bit of a theme. So African lions, also known as Pantheria leo, they're quite unique in the way that they have they basically develop social networks, have acquaintances for things like hunting or rearing cubs. And so what this recent study did was they were actually looking at, on the individual basis for the lion, or individual lions, how did they interact with other lions and how did that change over time?
Right.
So they use like 30 years worth of data. It's like over 150,000 observations of 665 lions. So a lot of data to see, you know, how did they interact with one another? And what they found was actually the two male versus female lions actually have different behaviors with age in terms of social connection. So for female to male connections, this is strongest in middle age and then it declines with age. But for female social connections to other females, they're highest in early adulthood and then they kind of decline, whereas with males it's lowest in midlife and increases with age. So females kind of become less friendly to one another, whereas males become more friendly to one another. The other thing that was really interesting was females that live longer tend to have stronger connections with their connections are stronger. However, with males, the ones that live longer, it's just the raw number of connections. So it's kind of a quality versus quantity sort of
that's
thing.
That's interesting, yeah.
Yeah, and so you can once you start observing these things, you can start to try and reason out why these might be. And so if you think about females' bonds where, you know, they were female-to-female bonds were really strong in early adulthood, and this could be because that's then your friends are helping you protect against threats.
Right.
You know, like, so, you know, lions are kind of known for male lions will kill other male lions, infants and stuff, right, for breeding. And so, you know, if you've got lots of your friends around there that can help you protect your cubs, that's good.
There's an evolutionary purpose there. Yeah.
You know, defending your territory, helping raise the cubs and stuff like this. And so, yeah, it's a really interesting study where it's been able to look at long-term data of wild animals, right? There's not animals in the zoo, so their behaviours, you know, because animals confined in the zoo are going to have a slightly different behaviour to animals in the wild.
Yeah, of course.
Also that they could use it to maybe predict how disease outbreaks will go through a lion population.
Right, because they give it to their friends. That's really
exactly cool. Right. So if you're thinking of older females, they're probably not going to be passing it along between each other because they don't interact with each other as much anymore. But the older males are. So depending on your pathogen that goes through, it may really like be of detriment to your older males more so than your older females. And so you can start to do these things. And, then, you know, like that's kind of what they did through COVID, if we think, with a lot of that COVID modelling.
Yeah,
you know, they were
stuff.
Looking at how people interacted with each other. And so, yeah, from this point on, now what they want to look at is how the loss of a friend influences an individual and its like social standing and where how its network works. So, you know, like, I guess in a way looking at like grieving and how So
That's really interesting stuff. Do we, sorry to spring this on you, do we know of any like other animals with similar sort of friendly relations?
So there will be. I don't know specifically of any examples. And one of the things that this study was saying is that there are now a lot of studies going on to look at social structures in other wild populations. But there definitely are. I just can't think of an example at the moment. But there are, groups that will
lots
help
of
raise.
Animals. Wow, yeah, really interesting stuff. Yeah. All right, thank you, Krishla, for coming in today. Thank you, Mosat, and thank you, Science. We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the bee.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to Mosat, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.